Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Epochs! Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I should be continuing my story all about Constantine I, Constantine the Great. And if you've been watching the last few episodes, I decided to spend quite a lot of time setting up that story. Haven't really talked much about Constantine himself, or hardly at all so far. Been setting up the age before him, the generation or so before him. That is the reign of Diocletian, the emperor who changed the entire system of government in Rome, changing it from a system Augustus had set up, the principate, to the dominate. Emperors going from, at least on paper, supposed to be the first citizen, the princeps citatus, and they're still supposed to get everything ratified by the Senate in Rome and all that sort of thing. Diocletian changed all of that to the dominate, what they call the dominate, where it's much more of a master-slave relationship. It's much more like a king and a subject relationship, even though that's the way in practice it had been for a long time. But now it's sort of formal and legal. And the tetrarchy, the rule of four, Diocletian had decided that the Roman Empire was just simply too big and too sort of unstable during the crisis of the 3rd century, because what we're talking about here is the late 3rd century, the late 200s, going into the very early 300s AD. And Diocletian had decided that he'll have four emperors. There'd be one, the most senior one, him, have a co-ruler, a co-Augusti, and under them, each one of those would have their own sort of a junior emperor, a Caesar. So there were two Augusti and two Caesars, four emperors in total. And they were all supposed to work together and work as one. And you've basically got four emperors so that each one of them can rule a different part of the empire, because as Diocletian calculated, it was just too big for one man. So that's the world in which Constantine was born into and grew up in. And his father was one of those emperors, Constantius. He had been one of the junior emperors, a Caesar, and his part of the empire was Britain and chunks of northwestern Europe, modern-day France, Belgium, Holland, places like that. And then when Diocletian had decided to retire, he sort of forced his co-Augustus, Maximian, forced him to resign as well, which means the two junior emperors, the two Caesars, are promoted effectively to senior emperors, Augusti, and then they would have to pick new Caesars. And so the cycle continues, the idea being that there won't be an endless cycle of usurpations, and because there will be no succession crisis, because you've always got an heir apparent. You've got the next one waiting to go. That's the idea. So Constantine's father, Constantius, has already been an emperor for a while. Arguably, some say the fourth most important of the four emperors. But now he's an Augustus. He's either first or second most important man in the empire. So that's where we are. I've been reading from Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon. So we shall continue reading from that. So let's pick up the story from after Diocletian's abdication, because if you remember as well, we talked about how he didn't just die in office, as most kings and emperors do. He actively, proactively decided to resign and abdicate and go and live in retirement. And he lived for quite a few years after that, 8-9 years. So let's let Gibbon continue the story. He says this, quote, "The balance of power established by Diocletian subsisted no longer while it was sustained by the firm and dexterous hand of the founder," i.e. after Diocletian retired, things start falling apart quite quickly. Gibbon goes on saying, "It required such a fortunate mixture of different tempers and abilities as could scarcely be found," because it did work while Diocletian was in control, because he handpicked exactly the right people to make it work. But as soon as that's not the case anymore, And it's difficult to find, difficult. A bit like, I've mentioned it before, didn't I? A bit like Bismarck's, the way Otto von Bismarck in the 19th century handled European affairs. Very, very deftly, very, very expertly. It needed his personal hand and mind to control most of the events for it to work. It was too delicate otherwise. Once he leaves, Bismarck leaves the stage of history, the whole edifice can and did come crumbling down. Well, something similar happened with Diocletian's system of government. Gibbon says that the right abilities and tempers could scarcely be found or even expected a second time. Two emperors without jealousy, two Caesars without ambition, and the same general interest invariably pursued by four independent princes. The abdication of Diocletian and Maximian was succeeded by 18 years of discord and confusion. This is the main part of our story, the rise of Constantine. The empire was afflicted by five civil wars, and the remainder of the time was not so much a state of tranquility as a suspension of arms between several hostile monarchs who, viewing each other with an eye of fear and hatred, strove to increase their respective forces at the expense of their subjects. As soon as Diocletian and Maximian had resigned the purple, i.e. being emperor, their station, according to the rules of the new constitution, was filled by the two Caesars, Constantius and Galerius. So Constantius, as I've said, is Constantine's father, and the other one, in the east, is Galerius. So again, remember that name, he's really important. If you recall, he was the one that had lost a battle against the Persians and been highly rebuked by Diocletian, but then given another chance and then gone on and won that war against the Persians. That's Galerius. He's the senior Roman emperor in the east now. Right, Galerius, who immediately assumed the title of Augustus. The honours of seniority and precedence were allowed to the former of those princes, and he continued under a new appellation to administer his ancient department of Gaul, Spain and Britain. That is Constantius. Gaul, Spain and Britain. The government of those ample provinces was sufficient to exercise his talents and satisfy his ambition. Clemency, temperance and moderation distinguished the amiable character of Constantius, and his fortunate subjects had frequently occasion to compare the virtues of their sovereign with the passions of Maximian. Do you remember Maximian was a soldier? Anyone or anything got in his way, he'll just kill them, butcher them, annihilate them. He had no real temperance or clemency. Well, that's not how Constantius does it. And even with the arts of Diocletian, Constantius was kinder and better and more noble of spirit even than Diocletian. Instead of imitating their Eastern pride and magnificence, Constantius preserved the modesty of a Roman prince. He declared with unaffected sincerity that his most valued treasure was in the hearts of his people, and that whenever the dignity of the throne or the danger of the state required an extraordinary supply, he could depend with confidence on their gratitude and liberality. One thing to say here, it may well be, this often happens in history, that when somebody becomes insanely powerful, you know, an all-powerful autocrat, an absolute monarch, and they've got the power to kind of rewrite history a bit, you know, the way Stalin tried, the way Mao tried, the way many, many ancient medieval kings and monarchs and potentates did. Maybe something like this is going on with Constantius because, spoiler alert, if you don't know, Constantine the Great becomes sort of all-powerful, and he may well have, probably did, have histories suppressed and or rewritten to make him and his family, of course including his father, seem better than they really were, rewritten to have the rosiest possible tint on it. So something like that may be going on with the histories, scant as they are, of Constantius. So take that, all that, what I've just said there, with a pinch of salt about how brilliant history seems to think Constantius was. Okay, Gibbon goes on saying, the provincials of Gaul, Spain and Britain, sensible of his worth and of their own happiness, reflected with anxiety on the declining health of the Emperor Constantius and the tender age of his numerous family, the issue of his second marriage with the daughter of Maximian. So here's a thing to say, because it comes up now, is that Constantius had basically two families. He'd been married as a younger man and had children. And Constantine, our Constantine, Constantine the Great, is the oldest son of that. And then his wife had died of natural causes and he'd got remarried. You know, it's not crazy. There's no wrongdoing or anything there. He'd got remarried and had more children with his new wife. So via two marriages and two women, he's got lots of children. And so, as you said there, his second wife was the daughter of Maximian. So what that means is Constantine has got half brothers and sisters that are the grandchildren of Maximian. They've got Maximian's blood in their veins, and they're Constantine's half siblings. Well, as you may well know, if you know your history, that quite often the fate of extra princes, especially in times that are more barbarous, the fate of extra princes may be a threat to you, whoever you are. Sometimes, often, they meet sticky ends. Okay, especially if, you know, like real power is up for grabs. Okay, Gibbon continues saying, the stern temper of Galerius, Galerius was a badass, was cast in a very different mould, and while he commanded the esteem of his subjects, he seldom condescended to solicit their affections, i.e. he didn't care that he was a badass and that everyone knew it, like a tyrant, sort of, you know. In fact, that was part of his policy. His fame in arms, Galerius, his fame in arms, above all, the success of the Persian War, had allayed his haughty mind, which was naturally impatient of a superior or even of an equal. That's a problem, is it? Galerius doesn't want other emperors. He doesn't like having equals. And well, that's the whole system of Diocletian's government, is that you're supposed to be sharing power with three others. But Galerius wasn't that type of man. Gibbon says, if it were possible to rely on the partial testimony of an injudicious writer, he's sort of saying there some of the histories from that time and not entirely reliable, we might ascribe the abdication of Diocletian to the menaces of Galerius and relate to the particulars of a private conversation between the two princes, in which the former discovered as much pusillanimity, which is like, you know, not being up for war, kind of a coward, not being prepared to have battles and wars all the time, shrinking away from that, as the latter displayed ingratitude and arrogance. But these obscure anecdotes are sufficiently refuted by an impartial view of the character and conduct of Diocletian. Whatever might otherwise have been his intentions, if he had apprehended any danger from the violence of Galerius, his good sense would have instructed him to prevent the ignominious contest. And as he had held the scepter with glory, he would have resigned it without disgrace. Because as I say, Galerius goes on to reveal himself to be almost like a Commodus or a Nero or a Caligula, or not quite as bad as those, but getting towards that. Did Diocletian know? Had Galerius kept all that hidden until he was a senior emperor? Or did Diocletian know? And if he did know, wouldn't he have done something about it? We don't know, of course, we don't know. Gibbon continues saying, after the elevation of Constantius and Galerius to the rank of Augusti, the two new Caesars were required to supply their place and to complete the system of the imperial government. Diocletian was sincerely desirous of withdrawing himself from the world. He considered Galerius, who had married his daughter, as the firmest support of his family and of the empire, and he consented without reluctance that his successor should assume the merit as well as the envy of the important nomination. It was fixed without consulting the interests or inclination of the princes of the West. Diocletian and Galerius picked their new Caesar without asking anyone else, without asking Constantius. Each of them had a son who was arrived at the age of manhood and who might have been deemed the most natural candidates for the vacant honour. But the impotent resentment of Maximian was no longer to be dreaded, and the moderate Constantius, though he might despise the dangers, was humanely apprehensive of the calamities of civil war. The two persons whom Galerius promoted to the rank of Caesar were much better suited to serve the views of his ambitions, his Galerius's personal ambitions, and their principal recommendation seems to have consisted in the want of merit or personal consequence. I.e. Galerius picks the two new Caesars and deliberately picks people that are weak and don't necessarily have ambitions, people he can hopes he can rely on to just do as they're told, so he can be the absolute undisputed emperor. There might be two other emperors on paper, but he will really, the full cockpit of power will sit with him alone, Galerius. The first of these new Caesars was Dazza, or as he was called afterwards, Maximin. Now, we'll call him, and Gibbon in history calls him Maximin a lot. Now, just to say, that's quite a similar name to Maximian, isn't it? So we've got to be careful, to always be careful whether we're talking about Maximian, the old, really badass soldier who was the co-emperor with Diocletian, or this new Maximin. And it gets a bit more confusing because later in the story, there are other people that, again, have got really similar names to this. So if I keep reminding you which one it is, it's probably for the best, because if you're not careful, you'll get the names mixed up. Okay, so one of the new Caesars is called Maximin, Gibbon tells us, whose mother was the sister of Galerius, a member of his family. Can hopefully be completely relied upon to just do as he's told at all times. The inexperienced youth, still betrayed by his manners and language, his rustic education, when, to his own astonishment, as well as that of the world, he was invested by Diocletian with the purple, exalted to the dignity of Caesar, and entrusted with the sovereign command of Egypt and Syria. At the same time, Severus, a faithful servant, not to be confused with an earlier emperor called Severus, a faithful servant addicted to pleasure, but not incapable of business, was sent to Milan to receive from the reluctant hands of Maximian the Caesarian ornaments and the possession of Italy and Africa. By Africa, it just means the North African coastline is what that really means. According to the forms of the constitution, Severus acknowledged the supremacy of the Western emperor, which is Constantius, but he was absolutely devoted to the commands of his benefactor, Galerius, who reserved to himself the intermediate countries from the confines of Italy to those of Syria, so sort of Eastern, Southern Europe and the Balkans and all that sort of thing, Illyria, which firmly established his power over 3/4 of the monarchy, because the whole rest of the East is Galerius's alone already. In the full confidence that the approaching death of Constantius would leave him sole master of the Roman world, we are assured that he, we're talking about Galerius here, had arranged in his mind a long succession of future princes, and that he meditated his own retreat from public life after he should have accomplished a glorious reign of about 20 years, i.e. just mirroring Diocletian. So Galerius thinks he's got all his ducks in a row here. He's got the two junior Caesars are completely in his pocket. He hopes, he thinks, they will do exactly as he tells them to. And Constantius is kind of old and known to be not that well. He's probably going to die sooner rather than later, at which point Galerius can promote Maximin, probably, and pick someone else who's going to be his puppet. And all three of the other emperors are just his creatures. And he can be effectively the sole ruler of the Roman world. That's what Galerius is hoping. He's looking into the future, thinking that's what's going to happen. But Gibbon tells us, quote, "But within less than 18 months, two unexpected revolutions overturned the ambitious schemes of Galerius. The hopes of uniting the Western provinces to his empire were disappointed by the elevation of Constantine, whilst Italy and Africa were lost by the successful results of Maxentius." So this is a whole new person, Maxentius. Right, so we've got Maximian, the old soldier. We've got Maximin, who's supposed to be a Caesar in Italy. And we've got this new person, Maxentius, who does play a role in this story a fair bit. Maxentius, another one whose name is similar. And he's just a general, a Roman general, who decided to revolt in the sort of the classic crisis of the third century way. His men, Maxentius's men, soldiers, think that if they just proclaim him emperor, they will be at the heart of power and they will get money and things. So they do. And Maxentius himself is ambitious. So we're starting to begin to return to the bad old days of the crisis of the third century, because the strong, firm control of Diocletian is no more. Okay, Gibbon goes on here to start telling us all about Constantine himself, because this will start to play out if and when Constantius, his father, does die of natural causes. What's going to happen next? Constantine isn't the Caesar. He isn't sort of legally supposed to take over from his father in any way. That's supposed to be this Maximin, or Maximin will be promoted to the senior Augusti in the West, and there'll just be somebody new. Somebody new will be picked, probably by Galerius. Galerius isn't going to pick Constantine, no way. So how does Constantine become an emperor, even a junior one? Well, Gibbon starts telling us the story. Here we are, finally arriving in detail about Constantine. We're told this, quote, "The fame of Constantine has rendered posterity attentive to the most minute circumstances of his life and actions. The place of his birth, as well as the condition of his mother, Helena, have been subject, that's Constantius's first wife, who died of natural causes, have been the subject of not only a literary, but of national disputes, notwithstanding the recent tradition which assigns for her father a British king, which almost certainly isn't the case. We are obliged to confess that Helena was the daughter of an innkeeper. So, you know, a nobody, a peasant, basically, little more than a peasant. But at the same time, we may defend the legality of her marriage against those who have represented her as the concubine of Constantius. Some say she was just a concubine. Some say she was the daughter of a king of Britain. But actually, she was the daughter of an innkeeper. So Constantine's father was an emperor of Rome, but his mother was a complete nobody. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.